From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Karl Rove and the White House political team are scrambling at this point not to maintain large majorities in the House and the Senate, but to save anything they can because they're terrified of a Democratic Congress that might hold them accountable.
Election Day is just 2 weeks away. It's the most pivotal battle for Congress in over a decade. Today, we spend the hour looking at some of the contests and issues that are shaping this year's midterm elections. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration is facing new opposition to the war in Iraq from within the U.S. military. For the first time since the invasion, a group of 65 active duty service members are formally asking Congress to end the U.S. occupation and bring the troops home. The soldiers are filing appeals for redress to members of Congress. Under the Military Whistleblower Protection Act, active duty troops can file and send a protected communication to a member of Congress regarding any subject without reprisal. One of the soldiers is Marine Sergeant Liam Madden of Rockingham, Vermont, who served in Iraq for 7 months last year. He told a Vermont newspaper, quote, "The war is being paid for by American people, and they're not seeing any benefit from it, and neither are the Iraqi people. It doesn't make sense to me," he said. The soldiers plan to publicly announce their campaign Wednesday. Sergeant Liam Madden said they hope to collect 2,000 appeals for redress and send them to Congress January 15th on Martin Luther King Day. In Baghdad, the U.S. military commander, General George Casey, held a rare joint news conference today with Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador in Iraq. Khalilzad urged Iraqi leaders to work harder to achieve key political and security goals. He said that success in Iraq is still possible and could be achieved in a realistic timetable. The press conference comes at a time when the White House is coming under increasing criticism over Iraq, even from Republicans. On Monday, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said, quote, "We're on the verge of chaos, and the current plan is not working." The White House has been vague about how it's going to alter its Iraq policy, but Press Secretary Tony Snow says the president will no longer say he wants to stay the course. In news from Baghdad, U.S. forces are searching for a missing military translator. The military said it doesn't know if the soldier, who's an Iraqi-American, was abducted or if he went AWOL. As part of the search, U.S. forces raided the studios of the TV station Al-Farat. Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Barham Saleh met with British Prime Minister Tony Blair in London. Saleh expressed hope that Iraqi forces could soon take over more responsibilities.
When we assumed sovereignty 2 years ago, the level of Iraqi troops and policemen were minimal. Today we are 300,000 strong in the police and in the military. They are getting better training, and we are establishing more units, and we hope by the end of this year, half of Iraqi provinces will come under Iraqi command.
Italy's top spy is expected to soon be indicted on charges connected to the CIA's kidnapping of an Islamic cleric from the streets of Milan in 2003. If indicted, Niccolò Pallari would become the most prominent official ever charged in connection with the Bush administration's so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program. Pallari has been the head of Italy's military intelligence for 5 years. According to the New York Times, the case marks the first time a foreign government official has been charged, essentially with cooperating with the United States to violate their own country's laws. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture said Monday the Bush administration's handling of the war on terror has allowed other countries to justify using torture. Manfred Nowak said, quote, "Today, many other governments are kind of saying, but why are you criticizing us? We're not doing something different than what the United States is doing." Nowak said, because of its prominence, the United States has a greater responsibility to uphold international standards. In business news, former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling has been sentenced to 24 years in prison for his role in one of the country's largest corporate scandals. Judge Simeon Lake said Skilling's crimes resulted in a life of poverty for thousands of people. At the sentencing, one former Enron employee called Skilling a liar, a thief, and a drunk, and accused him of cheating her and her daughter out of their retirement. after the sentencing, Skilling claimed he'd not committed any crimes.
I'm obviously not happy about it. I've got three children. I want to, you know, like anybody else, I'd like to spend time with my children. As I've said, I believe, I mean, deep down, this is no act or anything. I believe I'm innocent. And so I believe in the long run that the system, I think when we review this maybe in a somewhat calmer atmosphere than has existed for the last 5 years, I think people will really look at that, and I hope that it'll work out fine. I mean,
Reporters Without Borders has released its fifth annual Worldwide Press Freedom Index. It shows the level of press freedom in the United States continues to fall. The 2002 U.S. was rated as having the 17th freest press. Now it's ranked 53rd. Reporters Without Borders criticized the Bush administration for using the so-called war on terror to crack down on press freedom. The report also criticized the United States for jailing journalists at home and abroad. Freelance journalist and blogger Josh Wolf remains in a San Francisco jail for refusing to hand over video to the police. Al Jazeera cameraman Samuel Haj has been locked up at Guantanamo for over 4 years. Associated Press photographer Bilal Hussein has been held in Iraq since April. Neither Al-Haj or Hussein have ever faced charges. Reporters Without Borders found the nations with the freest press were Finland, Iceland, Ireland, and the Netherlands. North Korea was rated as the worst upholder of press freedom. In related news, a Spanish photographer working for the Associated Press has been kidnapped in Gaza. Gunmen seized Emilio Marinatti when he walked out of his apartment this morning. The AFL-CIO has filed a complaint with the United Nations over a new federal labor ruling that could block millions of American workers from joining a union or being protected by the nation's labor laws. The Republican-controlled National Labor Relations Board recently broadened its definition of who can be considered a supervisor to include workers with incidental oversight over co-workers. Under federal law, employees defined as supervisors aren't entitled to legal protections, ensuring their right to join unions. The AFL-CIO filed its complaint with the International Labor Organization of the United Nations. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has also criticized the Labor Board's decision, saying it puts the United States in violation of its labor and human rights obligations under international law. The group said the ruling creates a new category of employees— people without the authority of real supervisors and without the rights of ordinary employees. Former UN Chief Arms Inspector Hans Blix said Monday, the world needs to make clear to North Korea they're not trying to overthrow the regime as they try to persuade North Korea to stop developing nuclear weapons.
It might be more useful to say, look here, we are not out for regime change here. That's for the Korean people and for you to do. But the world is very concerned if you move on with the nuclear weapons. And we, the outside world, are willing to try to create conditions where you don't need them. We can give you assurances on paper that you will not be attacked from the outside and that we will not try to change your regime.
Hans Blix also criticized the United States for promoting a double standard.
We all regret and even the Security Council condemns the tests. But we must remember then that they are condemned for doing something that the U.S. and other countries are reserving themselves the right to do. The United States has refused to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and they keep test areas open in the United States. So here is someone like telling that Korea, you must not do that, but we, of course, might do so in the future.
Election monitors from the Organization of American States have warned the Bush administration not to interfere in the upcoming presidential election in Nicaragua. The Bush administration has openly opposed the current frontrunner, Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega. The Organization of American States singled out Paul Trevelli, the U.S. ambassador to Nicaragua, and U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez for meddling in the November 5th election. Last week, Gutierrez said an Ortega victory could scare off foreign investors and jeopardize Nicaragua's participation in the CAFTA Free Trade Accord with the United States. New opinion polls show Ortega has taken a strong lead and could win the election in one round. Meanwhile, a leading Nicaraguan human rights activist, Vilma Nunez, is scheduled to testify this week about the U.S. interference before the Inter-American Human Rights Commission in Washington. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the Israeli military is withholding the release of a secret study that confirms there's been rampant illegal new construction in dozens of Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Some of the expanded settlements have occurred on privately owned Palestinian land. Security sources familiar with the study describe the study as political and diplomatic dynamite. Sources in the Israeli military said the report is not being made public in order to avoid a crisis with the U.S. government. Meanwhile, Palestinian leaders are condemning Israel's attack on the northern Gaza Strip that killed seven Palestinians Monday. Hamas leader and Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh denounced Israel for launching the raid at the beginning of Eid, the holiday that marks the end of Ramadan.
These threats to invade come as part of the overall escalation and the war which the Palestinian people are enduring. Here I assure you the Palestinian people will not be frightened by these threats, and the people of the Gaza Strip are steadfast against the occupation in the face of the rising Israeli escalation.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas described Israel's killings on Monday as a criminal massacre. And in Maryland, the headquarters of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was the scene of a protest yesterday over the Bush administration's handling of global warming. Two protesters occupied a ledge above the building's front entrance, an unfurled banner reading, "Bush let NOAA tell the truth." Other protesters on the ground blocked and occupied the building's main entrance. The demonstrators accused the agency of ignoring and actively suppressing science that details the great threat of global warming. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Election Day is 2 weeks away. It's being described as the most pivotal battle for Congress in over a decade. Today, we spend the hour looking at some of the key contests and issues that are shaping this year's midterm elections. Democrats have significantly improved their chances of taking control of both the Senate and the House. Polls now indicate four Republican incumbents in the Senate: Conrad Burns of Montana, Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, Mike DeWine of Ohio, and Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania are likely to lose their seats. If the polls are accurate, the control of the Senate will be decided based on the outcome of tight races in Missouri, Tennessee, and Virginia. The Democrats need to gain six seats to win control of the Senate. Meanwhile, the number of Republican House seats at risk has nearly tripled since January. According to the Cook Political Report, 48 Republican seats are now considered up for grabs. That's up from 18 at the start of the year. To take back the House, Democrats need a net gain of 15 seats. Overall, public support for the Republican-controlled Congress is at its lowest level in 14 years. According to an NBC News Wall Street Journal survey, just 16% of Americans give Congress a favorable rating. And for the first time ever, more than half of Americans now support Democratic control of Congress. We begin our coverage today with John Nichols. He's a political writer for The Nation magazine and associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He joins us on the telephone. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us, John. Well, why don't you start off by just laying out the election landscape and the races that you see pivotal in this country?
Well, it's a pretty remarkable landscape at this point for folks who've been watching politics over the years, because we really have not seen this many seats in play and, you know, open to go to either party in a very long time, perhaps since 1994. You know, our national politics is so corrupted by not just big money, but also redistricting processes that take most seats out of competition. It's very rare at this point in electoral cycle to see more than 15 or 20 seats in the House that are seriously competitive. As you just said, we've got around 50 or more at this point, most of them Republican-held seats. And then in the Senate, it's very rare again to see the Senate shift hands, but there is certainly that possibility. Where the action is in the House races is basically in an arc. Starts around Dubuque, Iowa, and it then comes across Illinois, through Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, up into upstate New York and over to Connecticut. Across those states, you're going to see roughly 20, 25 seats that could go to either party, but where you see a real trend toward the Democrats. The big issue, the big thing that seems to have shifted so many of seats into play, I think is essentially a discomfort with the Bush administration. The president's very low approval ratings is a big factor. But then you layer onto it things that you've covered well, the Foley scandal and things of that nature. And finally, I think an issue that is a sleeper issue in this campaign, but a very, very significant one, plays in both the House and the Senate races, and that is the U.S. trade policy in particular and economics in general. Most of these places where we see competitive seats, both at the House level and the Senate level, are places where the trade policies of the 1990s and more recent years, particularly NAFTA and free trade with China, have taken a real piece out of the regions, have been a real blow. And so I see in a place like Dubuque, Iowa, a seat that's been held by the Republicans for a decade, more than a decade, Bruce Braley, who's the Democratic candidate out there, seems to be running very well, apparently pulling ahead, with a very strong fair trade message, combined actually with a very strong anti-war message. I see a similar thing in the Ohio Senate race, where Sherrod Brown, the congressman from northern Ohio, appears to be running comfortably ahead of incumbent U.S. Senator Mike DeWine, again with a combination of an anti-war message as well as a very, very strong message on domestic economics, particularly focusing on manufacturing.
And where does Karl Rove fit into this picture right now, John Nichols?
He fits in a very big way. Karl Rove has had a busy and complicated year. Of course, as listeners to this show know, he was the subject of a very serious federal investigation that is apparently done, although his hands still are being watched closely by a lot of folks. So many people believe he was off his game for much of the year. At this point, he's very much back in the game. He is the political czar of the Republican Party. And what we've seen in recent weeks is a fascinating sort of endgame strategy. The Republicans know they're in trouble. They recognize that an awfully lot of their seats are vulnerable. There's only one person in the party with enough authority to use basically both his own prestige as well as the imprimatur of the president to begin making the really tough decisions, and they are making them. They are telling incumbent U.S. senators that the party is just not going to be there for them, that money is going to be shifted out of their races. And we hear a lot of reports that money is being shifted out of the Ohio race between Sherrod Brown and Mike DeWine because it doesn't look like DeWine can pull it off, and because Ohio has a lot of media markets. If the Republican Party stays active there, they eat up a lot of money. Money being shifted out of Pennsylvania in the race between Bob Casey and Rick Santorum, again, because it looks like the Democrat is ahead. Usually a senior senator or a senior House member can say to the National Party, to the congressional campaign committees, I need your money and you have to give it to me. At this point, Karl Rove is saying to some of his senior members of Congress, you're not going to get our money because we're in a desperate situation. What the Republicans want to do at this point is shift their money to small states and competitive congressional districts where they can get the most bang for their buck, if you will, in an effort to maintain a one- or two-seat majority in the Senate and a three- or four-seat majority in the House. They are doing that very specifically, without any question, because they do not want House committees in particular to fall to Democratic control. They don't really fear Nancy Pelosi all that much for all of their screaming and yelling about her. What they really fear is having Henry Waxman in charge of the House Government Reform Committee. Waxman is a very passionate reformer, but he's also a very passionate investigator. They're troubled by the idea of the investigations he might launch. They are also very specifically frightened by the notion that Dave Obey will take charge of appropriations and restore the fraud investigation units there. And finally, there's no question at the House level they're very afraid that John Conyers will take over judiciary for all the reasons that listeners to this show are well aware of.
Hasn't John Conyers, in fact, though he's gone back and forth on this, discussed talking about the impeachment of President Bush?
There is no question of that. And one thing to be very conscious of, and I've watched these races district by district around the country, candidates who have come from behind and scored unexpected wins in primaries and are, in fact, doing very, very well now in the general are often the ones who say bluntly, we have to hold this president to account. And they don't just say, I'm against the war, I'm concerned about the economy, I'm concerned about stem cell research, all the standard lists. They say that Congress has been laying down on the job. In fact, fascinatingly enough, some of the people who are really breaking through, like Keith Ellison, who is the Democratic candidate up in Minneapolis area, and who is going to win that seat, it's an open seat, has been saying he's running for Congress because he wants to hold this president accountable for what he did with the war in Iraq. Similarly, you see several of the candidates who are doing very well in Pennsylvania, Admiral Sestak, who probably will win the Kurt Weldon seat, again taking away a traditional Republican seat, saying that the issue in this race is presidential accountability. And so, yes, you're right that John Conyers has been a little cautious in recent weeks about talking of impeachment. The Democratic establishment in Congress has basically brought the hammer down on him and said, don't you dare discuss the issue. But the fact of the matter is, out at the district level and in some of the Senate races as well, those candidates who are talking about accountability are getting a lot of traction with it. They're not necessarily saying impeachment per se, but they are clearly saying that they're not afraid of holding hearings, of investigating, of, you know, trying to figure out what exactly went wrong with Iraq and also what's happened with war profiteering and a host of other issues. As we lay these things out, you can understand why the White House political czar, Karl Rove, is so very concerned about playing a really strategic game, fighting really hard to maintain control of these two houses of Congress. It isn't just about Republican, you know, hegemony. It isn't about advancing an agenda. There's very little the Bush administration will be able to accomplish in these next 2 years. The fundamental issue here is whether there is a Congress that will investigate, will inquire, will hold hearings. And the Bush White House really does not want that.
We're talking to John Nichols. He writes for The Nation magazine. He's also associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. We're going to come back to him and also focus more on this anti-war message, candidates who are focusing on Iraq, how they're doing. And we're going to look at African-Americans in races. And finally, we're going to Connecticut and looking at that Lamont-Lieberman race and how war fits into that. We'll be speaking with a commentator in Connecticut. Stay with us.
Yeah, election time's coming. Who you gonna vote for? Yeah. If I was president, I'd get elected on Friday, assassinated on Saturday, buried on Sunday. They go back to work on Monday. If I was president, if I was president, if I was president, yeah. Instead of spending billions on the war, I can use that money so I can feed the poor. 'Cause I know some so poor. When it rains, that's when they shower, scream and fight the power. That's when the vulture devours. If I was president, I get elected on Friday, assassinated on Saturday, buried on Sunday, they go back to work on Monday. If I was president, if I was president, if I was president, yeah.
If I were president, Wycliffe Jean here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking to John Nichols. He's associate editor of the Capital Times, also political writer for The Nation magazine. I'm Amy Goodman. John, on this issue of anti-war candidates and just how clear this message is at a time when the announcement has come down from the White House, from the spokesperson, Tony Snow, that the words, stay the course, will be officially eradicated from the president's lexicon. What about candidates around the country?
Well, the fascinating thing that's occurred is that the message, stay the course, which they thought was a great slogan, especially for this electoral cycle, has come to haunt the Bush White House. Many Democratic candidates around the country have crafted campaigns that turns stay the course into a threat rather than a promise. And for the first time, really, since the war began, in fact, even before the war began, you're seeing a lot of Democratic candidates cutting ads, putting them on TV, talking about the war in Iraq and what a disaster it is, and turning the issue around on the White House. This has shocked the White House. They never expected this to happen. Same with the Republican Senate and congressional campaign committees. They never thought the war would actually be an on-TV, out-front, in-the-debates issue. But it clearly is. The classic example is out in Ohio, where Sherrod Brown, during the last 4 years, has been easily one of the most outspoken critics of the war. He voted against going to war. He voted against the Patriot Act as well. He was remembered by some folks for going to the floor of the House in the early days of the war with Lynn Woolsey, one of the other very anti-war members, represented from California, and reading letters from families that were worried about their kids going off to Iraq into the congressional record as a way of saying, you know, not everybody's excited about this war. That was at the same time that, you know, there was all the theater about pulling down Saddam's statue over in Baghdad. This is a guy who's really anti-war. He's got a long record. The Republicans thought they were going to defeat him on this issue, that they would put up ads about his defense record and just destroy him. Instead, Brown is the one who's been very aggressive, bringing the issue into play. The same with Bruce Braley, who I mentioned earlier, the candidate out in eastern Iowa. He won his primary by distinguishing himself as the more anti-war candidate, and he's held to that position. Around the country right now, I see a couple dozen House candidates, new players, who are clearly running on an anti-war message. And that's not, it's not a soft anti-war message. It's not, I'm concerned. It's, if you elect me, I will work to establish a timeline to bring the troops home. And if my read is right, I would say probably, you know, these are the 20 to 25 I'm talking about are in close races. The majority of them will win. And what's important about that is not merely the message that comes through for, you know, the White House saying that perhaps they lose control of the House of Representatives. It's also a message for the Democratic Party, because throughout this campaign, the National Democratic Party has tried very hard to avoid tough issues. They don't want to talk about the war. They certainly don't want to talk about impeachment. But at the ground level, we're seeing a lot of candidates who've gone way beyond the party playbook, way beyond the official strategy, if you will, and had a lot of success with it. I'm excited not about particularly a Democratic majority, Republican majority, something like that. I'm excited about a change in the character of the opposition party. And if that happens, we're going to have a very different Congress, a much more interesting Congress. There are some folks who have a very good chance of getting elected and who have promised their constituents that they're going to Washington to do something about this war. If that happens, I think it's going to be a much noisier Congress, and a Congress that in many senses will return to what the founders of the Republic intended, and that is an institution that checks and balances the executive branch in a way that this Congress has not done. I'll tell you one final thing that's important as well. There's a lot of rumbling among Republicans, people like Jim Leach, the congressman from eastern Iowa, who are basically indicating that if Democrats take control of the House, it won't just be a Democratic majority that is demanding a shift in White House policy as regards Iraq, that there are a number of Republicans who have been chomping at the bit, if you will, and are ready to start talking about this issue. So this election has the potential on the issue of Iraq to be a very significant turning point in the debate by giving the Democratic Party some members who will give it more backbone than it's shown, well, and also by freeing some Republicans up.
One of the most closely watched races this election is in Tennessee. Congressmember Harold Ford is running against Chattanooga Mayor Bob Corker for the Senate seat being vacated by the retiring majority leader, Dr. Bill Frist. The race has gotten increasingly close in recent weeks, with Democrats hoping this seat will be one of the six seats needed to regain their majority. Harold Ford is a five-term Democratic congressmember who comes from a political family. His father, Harold Ford Sr., served as a congressmember in the district currently represented by his son. Seven other Fords have also held political office in the state. If Ford is elected, he'll be the first black senator from a southern state since Reconstruction. Mike Wenger also joins us now from Washington, D.C., in addition to John Nichols. Mike Wenger is the acting vice president for communications at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. We welcome you as well to Democracy Now!, Mike.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Can you talk about this race, the Corker-Ford race for Senate?
Sure. Harold Ford has run a remarkably excellent campaign. He wasn't given much of a chance in the beginning, being African-American, running statewide in Tennessee, a southern state, but he's run a terrific campaign. Bob Corker has made some mistakes along the way, and Ford now appears in the polls to be a couple of points ahead. However, I would caution there that in the past, polling has been notoriously inaccurate when it comes to statewide African-American candidates. Because of political correctness, what you see is white people telling pollsters that they will vote for the African-American candidate, but when they go into the voting booth, they often don't do that. We saw that in California several years ago when Tom Bradley was favored to be elected governor of California, and he lost. Harvey Gantt, who was favored to be elected to the Senate from North Carolina, he lost. Doug Wilder was elected governor of Virginia, but in the polling up to Election Day and in the exit polling, he was 10 points ahead, but he won by about 1 point, while his running mates won by about 10 points. So there has to be some caution here regarding the polls in Tennessee. Having said that, Harold Ford has run a terrific campaign. Things are changing. And Harold Ford has also run a fairly conservative campaign. He seems to be in sync with Tennessee voters on the issues. So that's going to be a very interesting race to watch right down to the end.
The Corker campaign is trying to distance itself from an advertisement created by the Republican National Committee attacking Harold Ford. The ad has drawn heavy criticism for being racially divisive. The 30-second spot features fictional characters satirizing Ford in mock in-the-street interviews. We're going to play a clip.
Harold Ford looks nice. Isn't that enough?
Terrorists need their privacy.
When I die, Harold Ford will let me pay taxes again.
Ford's right. I do have too many guns.
I met Harold at the Playboy party.
I'd love to pay higher marriage taxes.
Canada can take care of North Korea. They're not busy.
So he took money from porn movie producers. I mean, who hasn't?
The Republican National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Harold, call me.
That Harold call me is a white blonde woman winking into the camera. Hillary Shelton, head of the Washington office of the NAACP, told the Los Angeles Times the ad, quote, is a powerful innuendo that plays to pre-existing prejudices about African-American men and white women. Corker's campaign is now trying to distance itself from the ad. In a letter to station managers, the chair of the campaign, Tan Ingram, called the ad over-the-top, tacky, and not reflective of the kind of campaign we're running. Ingram went on to write, we're disappointed that the advertisement continues to run and request station managers across the state strongly consider pulling this advertisement immediately. Mike Wenger, your response.
Well, this is not the first time this kind of thing has happened. When in the past we've seen very divisive ads with regard to African-American candidates where they play on racial fears of white people. We saw that during the first President Bush campaign in 1988, the Willie Horton ad, which clearly played on white fears of African-Americans, and it was very effective. So as long as those kinds of ads are effective, they'll be used. But there is no question that this ad plays to white fears and is racist in its nature.
What about the issue of black voter turnout overall?
Well, that's important, and that's particularly important in close races across the country. In the three Senate races that your previous guest talked about that will probably determine the control of the Senate, Tennessee, Missouri, and Virginia, black turnout's going to be critical. Harold Ford obviously needs huge turnout of black voters. In Missouri, Claire McCaskill, the Democratic candidate, needs a huge turnout of black voters. And in Virginia, Jim Webb needs a huge turnout of black voters as well. That's an interesting race, of course, because of George Allen's stumbles over the word macaca and his use of the N-word, and that may drive up African-American turnout in that race, which would be to Jim Webb's benefit.
On the issue of Ford back in Tennessee, if he's elected, it'll be the first time in a long time that two black senators are in office at the same time. Of course, Senator Barack Obama from Illinois, he is not running now, though you might say he is running, possibly for president, has just made this big announcement. And in a number of the articles I've read about him is really looking at this race, Harold Ford's race, for how an African-American will do in the South.
And he'd do well to look at that race, because Harold Ford has run as a fairly conservative candidate. He's played up his faith, his religious faith. So I think that that Barack Obama would do well to look at the Ford campaign as an indication of how an African-American can run in the South. I would point out, furthermore, the significance that you raised of having two African-Americans in the Senate at the same time. As you know, the first African-American U.S. senator since Reconstruction was Ed Brooke, who was elected in Massachusetts, a Republican, by the way. Then Carol Moseley Braun from Illinois, and then Barack Obama. But we've never, since Reconstruction, had two African-Americans in the Senate at the same time. That would make a significant difference. It's one thing to be a lone voice. It's another to have some company when you raise your voices on issues of particular concern to your community.
Can you talk about other African Americans who are running? For example, Michael Steele in Maryland, Ken Blackwell in Ohio, Lynn Swann in Pennsylvania running for governor, the former football player.
Well, Ken Blackwell and Lynn Swann are Republicans. They're almost surely not going to win. Ken Blackwell has been a victim not only of the problems that President Bush has, but he's been a victim of a number of scandals that have beset the Republican Party in Ohio. Lynn Swann is running against a fairly popular Democratic governor in Pennsylvania, incumbent Ed Rendell. He's unlikely to win. Michael Steele has run a very effective campaign in Maryland, but Maryland's a very Democratic state, and in a year that looks to be good for Democrats, Michael Steele's going to have a hard time. If this were a different year and the Republicans were not in such deep trouble, Michael Steele would have a very good chance to be elected to the Senate from Maryland. As it is, he's probably not going to win.
John Nichols of The Nation and the Capital Times, you've looked at Ken Blackwell in Ohio.
Sure. Look, Ken Blackwell's in terrible trouble. He's not going anywhere. He's down, depending on which poll you look at, 12, 15 points. Some polls showed a little closer, but the Republicans have pretty much given up on that race. And the significant thing about Blackwell is that, unlike Michael Steele, who our other guest references, who's worked hard and developed at least a reasonably good reputation in the African-American community in Maryland, Ken Blackwell is really on the outs with the African-American community in Ohio, because he is seen as having been so heavily involved in efforts to depress the black vote in the 2004 presidential race. And frankly, many Republicans I talked to in Ohio say that Blackwell is a drag on the ticket. He is more harmful than helpful, and the weakness of Ken Blackwell may actually be, you know, one of the many factors that helped to defeat U.S. Senator Mike DeWine out there.
overall, Mike Wenger, on the issue of African Americans across the board, not only in federal races, but in state races? And John Nichols, I know you've been looking at state houses as well. Is minority representation up in this country in terms of elected office?
Well, sure. They're about, in all offices at all levels, there are about 9,500 black elected officials now across the country. That compares to under 1,000 when the Joint Center was founded in 1970. We're going to, in all likelihood, see another African-American governor this year, Deval Patrick, a Democrat in Massachusetts. We're likely to see at least two African-American lieutenant governors elected, David Patterson in New York and Anthony Brown in Maryland. And according to the most recent polls that I've seen, the race in Florida is getting closer, and the Democratic candidate for governor and lieutenant governor were down pretty far. But now that race is tightening up, and Darrell Jones, an African-American man, is candidate, Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor in that state. So we will see, in all likelihood, more African-Americans in statewide offices, and not just governor and lieutenant governor, in many other offices in Georgia, Illinois, Connecticut, Ohio, other states. There are African-Americans holding statewide elected office now.
There's a piece in the Los Angeles Times today, Latino and black voters reassessing ties to GOP. And it says a major effort to draw Latinos and blacks into the Republican Party, a central element of the GOP plan to build long-lasting majorities, in danger of collapse amid anger over the immigration debate and claims that Republican leaders have not delivered on promises to direct more money to church-based social services. The LA Times goes on to say President Bush, strategist Karl Rove, and other top Republicans have wooed Latino and black leaders, many of them evangelical clergy, who lead large congregations in hopes of peeling away the traditional Democratic base. But now some of the leaders who helped Bush win 2004 are revisiting their loyalty to the Republican Party and, in some cases, abandoning it. Mike Wenger.
Yeah, well, I don't think they've actually been very successful in breaking any significant number of African Americans away from the Democratic Party. All you have to do is look at the positions that Republicans at the national level have taken over the past years, and African American voters are smart. They look at positions that people take, and so I think Republicans have not been very successful in any event in peeling away very many African American voters. With regard to Latino voters, I think the immigration issue is huge. We saw that a number of years ago in California, which was a competitive state for Republicans until Prop 187 and Pete Wilson, the then Republican governor of California, supporting Prop 87, which is anti-immigration anti-immigrant referendum. And Latinos have voted heavily for Democrats in California since then and made California a pretty solid Democratic state. I think that Republican position on immigration has the danger for them of driving Latinos to the Democratic Party and negating any hope that the Republicans might have had of getting a significant percentage of Latino votes down the road.
Mike Wenger, I want to thank you for being with us, Acting Vice President for Communications at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and also John Nichols of The Nation magazine, Associate Editor also of Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. John Nichols' new book is called The Genius of Impeachment. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375, Link TV. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. We also have our headlines in Spanish and transcript and audio form for any radio station to take, as scores are through Latin America and the United States. As we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour tomorrow night, I will be at Barnes & Noble in New York, Union Square, at 7 o'clock. And on Thursday, in Loch Sheldrake at Sullivan Community College at 7 o'clock. On Friday, in Olympia, Washington, we'll be celebrating Chaos. That's K-A-O-S Radio. Saturday, in Mount Vernon, Washington, and also Bellingham, Washington. On Saturday night, I'll be speaking in Vancouver, Canada. And on Sunday, I'll be speaking in Victoria, British Columbia. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for more of the Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, celebrating media that breaks the sound barrier. As we turn now to Connecticut, Ned Lamont, the wealthy telecommunications executive, is trying to pull off a second upset over Senator Joseph Lieberman after defeating him in the Democratic primary this summer. Lieberman's running as an independent, but says he'll caucus with Senate Democrats if he keeps his seat. Despite a celebrated victory in the primary, Lamont now faces an uphill battle. The latest polls show him trailing Lieberman by 17 percentage points. Last night, the two frontrunners, along with Republican Alan Schlesinger, held their final debate before the election. And themes that have marked their respective campaigns, Lamont criticized Lieberman's support for the Iraq War and other policies of the White House. Lieberman defended his record and said Lamont's call for withdrawal timetable of U.S. troops from Iraq would lead to disaster. The debate came hours after Lamont filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission, accusing Lieberman of failing to account for nearly $400,000 in campaign spending in days before the Democratic primary. For more on this race, we go to Hartford, Connecticut. We're joined by Bill Curry, former Connecticut state controller and state senator, and twice the state Democratic nominee for governor. Curry served as counselor to President Clinton from 95 to 97. He now writes a weekly column for the Hartford Current. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bill.
Great to be here, Amy. Thank you.
Well, can you talk about this race, the Democrat, the so-called independent, and the Republican?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a 17-point race. I think that Lieberman clearly has an advantage, but it's not that wide an advantage. The second thing I would say is that it has been a race in which the distinctions have blurred in the general election. And I would say that Lieberman has run a more thematic race. Lamont has tried to run a more substantive, concrete issue-based race. Lieberman's run on experience, bipartisanship, fear of attack from abroad, and he's also presented himself as a victim of unfair attacks from Lamont. And it strikes me that Lamont hasn't done a great job of countering that. You know, what a year to run an experience. This is the most experienced Congress, literally, in modern history because of gerrymandering, government propaganda, and special interest money. How are they doing? You know, what have we gotten out of that? In terms of bipartisanship, this has been the least bipartisan president, certainly in my memory. You can't claim to have gotten compromises out of the Bush crowd, but only to go along with them. I think Joe Lieberman's mistake, in a sense, you could say, is being bipartisan with the wrong Republicans. There are plenty of people here in Connecticut who've been looking for alternatives to Bush's leadership, but not something you accomplish by aligning yourself with Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld. And so Lamont has had a lot of openings, but I haven't seen him take advantage of them. And if anything, he's become somewhat more of a classic Democratic candidate, blurring distinctions and being very, very careful on issues. And I think it's sapped some of the momentum from his campaign.
What if
I'm having a little trouble? Go ahead.
If you could bear with the sound, if you're having a little trouble, what effect does Karl Rove have on the Democrats?
Well, Karl Rove frightens the Democrats to death. And I think what happens is that, I just point out two things. One, Rove's game, I guess it's brilliant. It's stale. We've seen him run it again and again. It's a miracle it keeps working. What Rove does is frighten all the Democrats who've been battered by the culture wars and by their political reverses in all these years. He frightens them with the tag extremist. And the Democrats are so fearful of being labeled extremists that they say absolutely nothing. And then voters vote against them because they had nothing to say. You could call it the John Kerry effect, I think, fairly in that race. And I see it here. And I was listening to John Nichols' very smart observations. In Connecticut, certainly, it's a little different than it is in the industrial Midwest. We don't have many populist candidates running in this part of the country. I agree that even here, less than in Michigan, but strongly, trade would be a very a powerful issue. The erosion of jobs, the fact that the American middle class hasn't gotten a raise in a generation, the fact that the baby boomers are about to die broke and didn't see it coming. There are a lot of fundamental issues here, but you don't find Democrats running on them. Instead, you know, my old White House colleagues, Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Reed and a handful of other sort of consultant types in Washington, have made most of the congressional candidates in this country sound exactly the same. The usual Democratic strategy, no doubt in part because of Rove, for the usual Democratic strategy for winning is basically just to wait and hope the other side punts. You know, our grand plan is usually to win by default. This is a year in which people's dissatisfaction with Bush is so strong, their desire to put him under some kind of political house arrest is so deep, that the strategy is going to work, I think almost certainly. They then, however, get up the next morning and they need a plan to govern, and it's not evident. It's not as evident to me as it as perhaps it is to John what exactly that'll be.
Bill Curry, if Lieberman were to win, while he says he will caucus with the Democrats, he doesn't help the balance of power for Democrats in taking the Senate, right?
No, it's a Democratic seat. And one of the things that's happened in Lamont, in fairness, we have three very competitive House races in this state. In the 2nd District, my lifelong friend, a great progressive, Joe Courtney, is in a dead heat with a former CIA operative, Rob Simmons. Diane Farrell challenging Chris Shays in Fairfield County, and Christopher Murphy challenging Nancy Johnson, the architect of our modern health care system. In the 5th Congressional District. These are exciting races. They're all in a dead heat.
What do you mean, frankly, Johnson is the architect of the modern healthcare system?
In a very real way, Nancy Johnson has been the single most influential member of her party in Washington on health care for the quarter century that she sat in Congress. She chairs the subcommittee on health care and Ways and Means. And it would actually, if you were to simply say, who is the living American who has most given us this debacle of a health system, it's hard to imagine who other than Nancy Johnson you would suggest for that honor. Again, it's like the experience argument. You know, how do you feel that's working? Nancy was also a key architect of the Gingrich Revolution, an important lieutenant in his fight to take over power, and then the chair of the Ethics Committee, who began the process of the Ethics Committee no longer doing its job at all, staving off investigations past an election, and then finally leaving the position herself, but creating a tendency there that's lasted a long time to turn a blind eye to obvious misdeeds. And that race, again, we're all aware of the problem. You know, all these and the Republicans are hanging their hats on it, that people like their own congressman so much. The congressman's personal favorabilities are higher. Most Americans only learn about their own congressman from the congressman's taxpayer-funded mailings and self-flattering press releases and ads. There aren't enough reporters left from the states even covering Washington to tell them anything else. So the Congress is at an all-time low because we have the data of the news and the quality of our own lives to help us evaluate the institution. But all we have in the individual members is what they tell us about themselves. Therefore, you have this odd phenomenon of individual congressmen being very popular despite the fact that the institution is detested. And in Connecticut, they're hoping that'll happen. You also have had gerrymandering as a factor here in a very strong way, and all three Republican incumbents will outspend their challengers by a substantial margin. Nevertheless, what it feels like here is such a strong tide coming in that it's just one of those deals where I think it's far too much. And even though I don't think the Democratic candidates have done a very good job of arguing the differences, I think the really important debates right now are going on inside people's own heads, and they're just taking a look at what they see, at their own lives, at Iraq, at the squalor in Washington, and they're going to vote to change this.
Bill Curry, you're talking to us from Connecticut, but you're looking races in the Northeast. What about Rhode Island, a very close race there for Senate?
Rhode Island and Connecticut, you know, each state is about, you know, like the size of Monaco, and we're very similar in some ways. But Rhode Island is a much more Democratic state. Connecticut, actually, we're a blue state, but we're a swing state. Three of those five House seats have been Republican now for a long time. We've had a Republican governor. I lost twice to a multiple felon, John Rowland, running for governor, an unusual distinction. We swing back and forth in the presidential races. Rhode Island is a much more deeply a Democratic state. And Sheldon Whitehouse is, again, he's sort of the perfect profile of what the Democratic Party likes to run. He's a former prosecutor. He's a former attorney general, where you can develop a strong patina of consumer activism. I think he is a decent candidate, by the way. And I think right now that he's ahead. I know that that's the closest of the four races that people say lean strongly to the Democrats. But given the nature of the state and the qualities of the two candidates, in the end, I think that'll be Sheldon Whitehouse's to lose, and I don't think he will. I think he'll take it.
Lincoln Chafee has not exactly been a favorite son of the Republican Party, though
no.
His father also
no.
was a senator.
Although, yes, and there's a strong family named Lincoln Chafee, who was a blacksmith, actually shoed horses at a racetrack for a number of years, and then became a mayor in, I believe, Warwick, Rhode Island, and then advanced to the family barony of the Senate seat. And I think that he seems like a nice guy when you see him on C-SPAN. He has broken with his party a number of times. But there are two issues that are out there. And by the way, the Republicans are coming in. And as with Chris Shays in Connecticut, who had never run negative ads and had always been more of a maverick, now that they're aligned with their parties, these guys are running campaigns that would make you cringe. The basic question here, even for all these undecided voters in the middle, I mean, in our country, two groups of people vote their interest with ruthless intelligence, the very rich and the very poor. In the middle are a lot of confused people. And one of the things that they like to say is, I don't vote the party, I vote the person. I think this is the first year in my adult life in which no one said that to me, that the fundamental argument that John Nichols was raising earlier, you have a constitutional system of checks and balances that's had no checks and no balances. And it's not a question of whether Democrats are going to come in and conduct witch hunts. People desperately want to see oversight of the executive branch by the legislative branch of government. And I just think that in the end, as all this the sludge of the 30-second ads fades, as all this as we come to the end of it, the voters stop listening, and the real important debates are within themselves, and they're going to vote for some kind of accountability.
Bill Curry, I want to thank you very much for being with us, former Connecticut state controller and state senator. He was the Democratic nominee for governor twice, now writes a weekly column for the Hartford Courant. And that does it for today's broadcast. You can get a copy of the show by going to our website at democracynow.org. Our transcripts are also there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Again, go to our website for our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour tomorrow night in Lock Sheldrick near Jeffersonville, then in Olympia, Washington, and we'll continue in Washington and Mount Vernon and Bellingham, then Vancouver, Canada. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.